and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the victory handed down to Republicans today by the Conservative majority on the Supreme Court, who ruled that the federal courts had no role in reining in partisan gerrymandering, a decision that will favour the GOP's stranglehold on democracy for decades to come, since Democrats already have to win 8% more of the vote just to break even with the Republicans. While some are breathing a sigh of relief that the Trump administration's push to add a citizenship question to the census was struck down for now, but it could be reversed, we assess the rightward turn of the court since Kavanaugh replaced Kennedy. And although some hold out hope that Chief Justice John Roberts is an institutionalist who does not want the Supreme Court to be blatantly partisan, his major rulings like Citizens United and today's green light for the Republicans to gerrymander clearly benefit Republicans. But his ruling on the census does show that as a textualist, he is following the text of the Constitution, which calls for all persons in the United States to be counted, thus exposing the hypocrisy of his right-wing colleagues in dissent in terms of their claim they strictly interpret the Constitution as written. Ian Millhiser, the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, joins us to discuss his latest article at Think Progress. It was a terrible day for democracy in the Supreme Court. Don't let the census case fool you. Then we will get an assessment of Wednesday night's first round of Democratic presidential primary debates, in which half of the crowded field of candidates vied for precious airtime to differentiate themselves by staging moments of friction. Elizabeth Warren was the front runner among the candidates going into the debate, and she was front and center and the winner, according to most pundits. We look into whether the warning to rein in the increasingly left-wing rhetoric and policy positions by the more centrist Democrats, so as not to alienate the party's more conservative voters, was heeded. Matt Engel, a Democratic strategist who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, joins us to assess how much the Democratic candidate's strategy of not giving Trump any oxygen by mentioning his name was misplaced, since most Democratic voters feel strongly that Trump is a disaster for the country and must be voted out of office as soon and as overwhelmingly as possible. Then finally, we'll speak with the lead negotiator of the JCPOA, the P5+1 Iran nuclear deal, Ambassador Wendy Sherman, about the sharp downward turn in U.S.-Iran's relations since Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear deal, apparently because it had Obama's name on it. With Iran under an economic stranglehold and backed into a corner, will they adopt the Samson strategy of pulling the whole region down rather than cry uncle to Trump? And with two of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, Pence and Pompeo, believers in the rapture, is a religious war on the horizon. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And his latest article at Think Progress is, "It Was a Terrible Day for Democracy in the Supreme Court. Don't Let the Census Case Fool You." Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Millhiser.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for joining us. And let's talk about the census ruling, which at first blushes most of the press is reporting as defeat for the Trump administration. But I think if you read the conservative justices' opinions and the fact that this could, if the deadline is either in July, could be delayed to October, my understanding is that at the end of the day, this could end up being this question of citizenship could end up being on the census.
Right. So a bit of background here. The Trump administration wanted to add a question to the United States Census, which asks everyone if they're a citizen. That's something that hasn't been asked since the Jim Crow era. And the reason why is because there's all kinds of data, including data from the census's own in-house experts, saying if you ask that question, then a lot of immigrants won't respond, or they'll give inaccurate information and your data will be. And so, you know, this is something that is not asked. The Trump administration wanted to ask this, and I think pretty much everyone knows the real reason they wanted to ask the question is that if you prevent immigrants from participating in the census, that means that the states they live in, which a lot of which are blue states like California, will be shown to have fewer residents. So there'll be fewer California representatives in the House, and there will be more Republican representatives in the House. So this was just a way to tweak the population count in a way that gives a little marginal benefit to Republicans. The Supreme Court said that at least as the Trump administration tried to do it, they can't do it that way. There is a chance that they could revive it, although it's unclear whether they'll be able to. And I'm not 100% sure that the Supreme Court will let them get away with it if they do try.
Well, but first of all, the conservatives who voted against or voted in favor of having this question, they're so-called textualists. If you read the actual text of the Constitution, it says that they must count all persons in the United States.
Right.
How do they justify that hypocrisy?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to complain about in this opinion. I mean, I think it was wrong about the Constitution. I think it misread several statutes. What it did say, however, and this is important, so the Trump administration, when the federal government wants to do something, it has to give a reason why. Typically agencies, when they want to make policy changes, has to explain the underlying reasoning behind the decision. And so in this case, the Trump administration said, well, the reason we want to do this is if we have the citizenship data, it'll somehow make it easier for us to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Spoiler alert, they aren't interested in enforcing the Voting Rights Act. One of the many reasons we know they aren't interested in enforcing the Voting Rights Act is when you looked at the evidence in this case, it was clear that they were lying. It showed that Secretary Wilbur Ross came into office. He wanted on day one to implement the census question. They then went to DOJ and basically asked the Justice Department to make up this voting rights rationale so that the Commerce Department could claim that was their reason why. So they lied. And the Supreme Court said you can't lie that way. Like when you give a reason, it has to be a real reason. It can't be a pretext. And so at the very least, you have to tell us the real reason. And I think that that's significant for two reasons. I mean, one is because the real reason almost everyone believes is racism. And so if they come up with an explanation other than racism, it's probably going to be pretextual and it could get thrown out again. The second reason why it matters is because what the Trump administration wanted to do here is so egregious, so obviously unlawful. I mean, set aside the parts of the opinion that, I think they should have ruled on other grounds that this is unlawful. The Trump administration went into federal court and they lied, and then they lied to the Supreme Court. And I think that Chief Justice Roberts realized that this was not a circumstance where he could bail out the Trump administration if he wanted his court to be taken seriously and if he wanted to be perceived as anything other than a partisan hack.
But let's focus then on the fact that it doesn't seem entirely clear what the practical effect of this ruling is going to be. The question's barred for now, but it seems it's also possible for the administration to find some justifications for it, albeit they're short on time. But
right.
There is a suggestion that maybe they can extend the deadline to print the census from July to October. Are they going to come up with, in other words, are you satisfied that this ruling is going to stand, that this is not premature exuberance on the part of people right. who think, my God, at least the Supreme Court. On the one hand, on the gerrymandering case, they gave the Republicans a gift, or the Trump administration, but it is the Republicans, let's face it. But on this census question, they did the right thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, the short answer is that it all comes down to Chief Justice Roberts. I mean, procedurally, what could happen is that the Trump administration, now that they've been told, no, you can't give us this made up reason. You have to give us the real reason why you do it. They could come back, and I mean, they're not going to come back and say racism, but they could come back and, you know, come up with a new made-up reason. And then they'll come up with another made-up reason. There'll be another round of litigation. chances are some lower courts will strike the census question down or the citizenship question down again and say that, nope, we don't believe your new made up reason either. And then that will go up to the Supreme Court again. And if Chief Justice Roberts is determined to give the Trump administration a victory, he could, you know, there are ways he could expedite that. He could allow that to happen. He could flip his vote. I mean, I'm reasonably optimistic that's not going to happen. And the reason why I'm fairly optimistic that's not going to happen is that he's already made a choice. Like, if his goal was to give the Trump administration a victory, he would have given them a victory today. And that, you know, in the opinion he wrote, would have said something else. Now he's already stuck his neck out. He's already annoyed all of his Republican friends. He's already shined a big light on this case and called the Trump administration a bunch of liars. And if he turns around, you know, and I suspect the reason he did it is because to do anything else would be so lawless that he decided that this wasn't where he wanted to spend his political capital. And after doing all that to then turn around and flip his vote, he'd have to spend even more political capital. So, I mean, John Roberts is not a good guy. I mean, the other opinion that he wrote today was one that effectively legalized partisan gerrymandering. So he's very bad generally. He's very bad on democracy issues. But I think in this particular case, he realized it would be so utterly lawless and the price to the court's credibility would be so high if he had ruled in Trump's favor that he decided, you know what, guys, you're just going to take the L on this one.
The fact that its documents have been disclosed that Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, discussed the citizenship question with Stephen Bannon, and that was all done at the direction of Chris Kobach, the former Kansas Secretary of State, who's a zealous anti-immigration activist. And then, of course, then in April, we find out that these computer files of Thomas Hofeller, a Republican strategist, lay the whole strategy bare, that this is a partisan grab for the reasons you pointed out. It'll deny blue states that with a heavy population of undocumented occupants. The number of Democratic congressmen will be cut down and Republican congressmen will go up. It also affects allocation of funds as well. So that's the motive. Again, it's not dissimilar to the motives which appear to be behind the gerrymandering ruling. So did the revelations in those documents make a difference, do you think?
I mean, I think they very well may have. I think one lesson to take from this case is that Supreme Court decisions, especially these highly political, you know, very high-profile cases, don't happen in a vacuum. Like, it's not the case that the judges read the briefs and, you know, read the underlying cases and just decide what the law says. I mean, if this case was decided on the law, it would have been a 9-0 decision. There would have been no dissent. And the Solicitor General would have been sanctioned for lying to the court. And, you know, that's not what happened because the law isn't necessarily what matters. What matters is that when the law is on your side, you know, and you are arguing a liberal case, you can still win. But in order to win, you have to create a political environment where the court, or, you know, at least one member of the court decides it would be very damaging to them and to their reputation, to the court's reputation, and ultimately to the court's continuing political power if it were to do something so hackish as what the Trump administration was asking for here. And so I think it may very well have mattered that after this case was argued, more and more evidence just kept coming in that, yep, this is a case about racism. Yep, the reason they did this is racist. They had nothing to do with the law, had nothing to do with any legitimate policy concerns. And I think the combination of the fact that the law was completely against Trump and that the politics was now completely against Trump is what led Roberts to say, this is just not where I'm going to spend my political capital.
Well, let's turn to the other ruling, which, again, Roberts wrote the majority opinion. We conclude that partisan gerrymandering claims present political questions beyond the reach of the federal courts. Now, that does seem like a cop-out, but again, these decisions, just like Citizens United, do end up benefiting the Republicans enormously. There's no way in the world that Anthony Kennedy's naive idea that if you just have unlimited money in politics, there'll be disclosure. Well, there hasn't been disclosure. There are these dark vehicles like 501c4s, which are the favorite for oligarchs and plutocrats to buy our elections. That's happening, and it's been a massive advantage to the Republicans. And now there's no way in the world. First of all, just on the macro level, the Democrats in national elections have to win 8% more votes than the Republicans just to break even. These are the facts. So how in God's name can they get around the obvious question of whether these characters, these conservative justices, are political operatives in robes?
Right. Well, so what happened in the partisan gerrymandering case is the Republicans said that partisan gerrymandering is what's called a political question, which means even if it is illegal, federal courts aren't allowed to touch it. And the reasoning behind their argument was they said, look, there just isn't a way that judges can fairly look at maps and determine which maps are gerrymanders and which maps aren't gerrymanders, because, you know, it's not a case that, you know, the argument was that, like, it's not the case that every map needs to have perfect proportionality. No one thinks that's the case, you know, that if 54% of the votes go to Democrats, the Democrats need to get 54% of the seats. It's only when it gets really egregious that we say it's bad. And so how bad does it have to get? That was their argument. Their argument is wrong for a lot of reasons. One reason why it's wrong is because most of the sophisticated anti-gerrymandering advocates that I've spoken to, and, you know, including litigants in these cases, don't want proportionality. So proportionality means if you get 54% of the vote, you get 54% of the seats. If you get 43% of the vote, you get 43% of the seats. Most people don't think proportionality is the right rule. Most people want what's called symmetry. And what symmetry means is that each party gets the same result if they achieve the same amount of votes that the other party did in the last election. So you run one election, Democrats get 54% of the vote, maybe they get 65% of the seats. That's okay. It's okay so long as if 2 years later you run a different election, this time Republicans get 54% of the vote, and they also get 65% of the seats. So the question isn't whether or not the map always produces the right most proportional result. The question is whether it treats each party the same. And there's all kinds of sophisticated mathematical models you can use to determine whether or not a map treats each party the same. Roberts didn't want to allow that. He, you know, I mean, frankly, he engaged in a bunch of sophistry to argue that this was only about proportionality and not about symmetry. I think the decision is very unfortunate. I think it is wrong. But, you know, that was the reasoning there. The reasoning was that, you know, we're going to ignore these symmetry arguments, pretend it's about something else, and then reject that straw man.
Well, it's pretty clear that this ruling is in part result of Justice Kavanaugh joining the court. Because when the last time the Supreme Court addressed partisan gerrymandering, Anthony Kennedy was on the court, and they left the door open for some kind of solution, but now the door has been closed. And the idea that judges can't get their heads around it. I mean, the state level here in California, the redistricting commissions were led by retired judges. So how do they explain that? If you've got a test case here in California that shows that it works, why can't the judges on the Supreme Court or on the federal bench engage in the same kind of activity?
Well, I mean, like, you know, you said the reason why. It's because there's five Republicans on the Supreme Court, and Republicans don't want to strike down gerrymandering right now. And the reason why Republicans don't want to strike down gerrymandering is that gerrymandering is self-perpetuating. You know, once you gerrymander a legislature, you know, in Wisconsin right now, the legislature is so gerrymandered that in their last state assembly election, Democrats won 54% of the votes, but Republicans won 63% of the seats. So Democrats got a solid majority of the vote, 54%, and Republicans have a supermajority right now. That's how strong that gerrymander is. And what that means is that in 2020, when it comes time to draw redistricting, the Wisconsin legislature is going to be controlled by Republicans. Now, it happens to be the case that there's a Democratic governor this time around, so they'll probably have to work out some kind of compromise to because the Democratic governor can veto. But in each of these states where Republicans drew these gerrymandered maps, that means that they keep the legislature, and they keep the legislature until the next gerrymandering period. And if in addition to controlling the legislature, they control the governor's mansion when that time rolls around, then they can keep the gerrymander going for 10 more years and 10 more years after that and so on and so forth. They potentially entrench themselves in power forever. And so because Republicans had a really good year in 2010, you know, the 2010 elections were very good for the GOP. 2010 was the redistricting year. Whoever won that got to redraw all the maps. So they got to redraw a bunch of rigged maps. They now have an advantage because of gerrymandering. And of course, Republicans on the Supreme Court want them to keep that advantage. You know, if 2010 had been a great year for Democrats, and, you know, if 2008, which was a great year for Democrats, had been the redistricting year, I bet the Republicans on the Supreme Court would have said something totally different. But, you know, but here we are. Here we are with the decision that we have. And you're exactly right. It happened because Anthony Kennedy, who was a more moderate Republican, who was sometimes willing to see the light on things like gerrymandering, was replaced by a hardliner, Brett Kavanaugh. And Brett Kavanaugh has four friends who were willing to go along with them.
So at the end of the day, should the scales come off our eyes, and should we just recognize that the Republican majority on the court, the conservative justices on the court, all of whom are picked by Leonard Leo, who's an Opus Dei far right-wing Catholic zealot, that essentially what's going on here is that they are the ultimate Republican strategist. And in spite of demographics, in spite of the growing numbers of black and brown and minority people in this country who tend to vote Democratic, they are going to find ways either by money or by manipulation to keep the Republicans in power.
Well, I will say this, which is that there's a reason why Mitch McConnell pulled out every stop to keep Merrick Garland from being confirmed to the Supreme Court. And the reason for that is because it really matters who sits on the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court can choke off democracy. And, you know, we started off talking about the census case. You know, the census case is scary for lots of reasons. But one of the scariest things about it is that there were four votes on the other side. And that means that if Trump gets to replace any one of the five in the majority, any one of them, like, the position of the Trump administration was so lawless here that a judge that'll go for that will go for anything. They'll go for a joke lawsuit trying to kick out Obamacare. They'll go for another Bush v. Gore. They will go for anything. And so, you know, right now, the only thing standing between us and an oligarchy where the Supreme Court does pretty much whatever it wants is John Roberts. And John Roberts votes with the oligarchs most of the time.
Well, Ian Millhiser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And his latest article at Think Progress is, It Was a Terrible Day for Democracy in the Supreme Court. Don't let the census case fool you. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an assessment of Wednesday night's first round of Democratic presidential primary debates.
Choice. I wanna be elected.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Engel.
Hi, Ian.
So, Matt, in terms of Texas, the spat, the greatest amount of friction on the stage last night down in Miami in the first Democratic presidential candidate debate was between two Texans, Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke. Who got the better of that exchange, do you think?
Well, I think because of expectations that Castro got the better of it, because the expectations for him were lower and the expectations for Beto were higher. But I think it has been a little bit overblown, as though any real damage was done to Beto. I don't think Beto really was hurt. I do think, though, that Julian Castro was helped. He really displayed what a lot of us in Texas always knew, and that he's absolutely well-informed on a whole variety of issues, and he's got the ability to make a fist and deliver a blow. But I don't think that Beto was harmed. Beto did a good job. He made it clear that he's passionate about the issues that are most important to Democratic voters, and that he presents in a very well and attractive way.
So in terms of a spectrum from the left to the right, a lot of the after-action reports, if you will, coming out today in the press sort of suggest that, based upon what we saw last night on the stage down in Miami, that the Democratic Party seems to be drifting to the left. Delaney, I guess, was the only one, the former congressman from Maryland, that tried to pull things back to the right a little bit. How do you see it in that context?
I'm worried about that, too. I think that they focused more on ideological issues and on polarizing issues than I think that they should have. I think the Democratic Party as a whole is more centrist than the activists within our party, and that the overall electorate is certainly more centrist. I don't think it's nearly as far off the edge to the right as the Republicans, and it's certainly not as incompetent and indifferent and immoral as the Trump administration. So I think it's very important that Democrats who are running for president, first of all, demonstrate that they are able to reflect mainstream values in our country and that they're willing to stand up and go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump. And the only thing that I was concerned about with the debate last night was that they spent too much time on ideological issues, a little bit too much time focusing on each other, and not nearly as much time talking about the extraordinary damage that Donald Trump is doing to our country.
So there was little to no mention of Trump. So I wonder then, on the one hand, we know that the Democratic base is really fired up, and they just really can't stand Trump. And frankly, for full disclosure, I personally can't stand him. So that's going on at the base. The only person who mentioned him was Governor Inslee when they asked about what's the greatest threat to the United States, and various answers were global warming, the Middle East, whatever. And Inslee had the one word, President Trump. So on the one hand, it seemed to me that why give Trump more oxygen? He's a reality TV guy. He grabs as much TV as he watches TV almost all day long, and he grabs as much headlines as he can. So to my mind, it wasn't a bad strategy not to talk about him. But on the other hand, I think the base wants somebody up to run against this guy because they want somebody to deliver a knockout blow.
I think it goes beyond the base, Ian. I think that that's, in fact, one of the things that brings Democrats together, whether they're far left or more centrist, that there is a sense that Donald Trump is doing terrible damage, perhaps irreparable damage, to our country. And they want somebody who demonstrates the ability to go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump and is able to create the type of contrast needed for otherwise fair-minded voters to participate in the election, first of all, and then to make sure that they vote for Democrats, not only at the top of the ballot, but down ballot, so that you've got a Democratic-controlled Congress as well. I think that not having more focus on Donald Trump was a mistake. I think that that was a way for some of them to single themselves out. In fact, I think that Julian Castro's best line was when he said that on January 21st of 2021, we were going to say adios to Donald Trump. That's what got an applause in my household.
But just to touch on Delaney being the conservative Democrat basically saying that all this rush for Medicare for All is going to butt up against the fact that a lot of people in this country have private insurance, and particularly in terms of Medicare, there are lots of people with Medicare Advantage programs, which all would be taken away from them. So he was talking about something that needs to be discussed, obviously. But I didn't see him as a very credible messenger. On the other hand, Governor Steve Bullock of Montana would be so much better, I think, in terms of making a case for the more conservative Democrats or the more centrist Democrats if the field is too far tilted to the left. And he didn't even get on the stage. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I agree with you that I think the governor would be a much better spokesperson from that point for that point of view. I think that what we saw there was a warning sign rather than a direction signal to come this way. I thought that the other person that approached that with some responsibility was Klobuchar. Senator Klobuchar also really was, I think, pretty focused on the need to talk about health care in the right context and really focus on the fact that what Republicans want to do is take away basic right to have coverage for pre-existing conditions and to really talk about how the Republicans want health care to simply be a way for pharmaceutical companies to make money. And I think to the degree to which Democrats talk about breaking down systems that work and that not talking about having a capitalist economy that works for everybody, I think that we're really asking for trouble. And so I think that what happened last night was the rhetoric as much as the substance. The rhetoric got a little bit too far to the left. And again, I think the way to control that is to keep the focus on Trump. And I know there's some worry about giving Trump oxygen. Well, let me tell you, Trump's going to be in everybody's face anyway. I think if Democrats win in 2020, and I believe that we will, but if we win, it will be because the first decision the country made was to reject Donald Trump. The next part of that equation is deciding to be for our Democratic nominee. But in almost any race anywhere in the country, in order to defeat an incumbent, you've got to first get voters to reject that incumbent. And I think it's very important that the first case that's made is that Donald Trump's got to go.
So, Matt Engel, is there an explanation in the popularity of Joe Biden in the polls? He's way ahead of everybody and has been ever since these polls. And you could argue maybe they don't really, then there's something we shouldn't take too seriously because it's so early in the day. But nevertheless, that's the metric that people are using. Is Biden's popularity to do with the fact that he's seen that the Democratic voters are more centrist than they are to the left?
No, I don't even think it's that primarily. I think there are four things kind of in this order, to tell you the truth. One is he's seen by people who are actually paying attention at this point as the person who's got the best shot at beating Donald Trump. And again, I think that's the number one desire among Democrats. The second thing is that he's more well known. He's known by more people, and he's liked. People who know him like him. They don't have a lot of reasons not to like him. The third thing is that he, while it's not official, he doesn't have the endorsement of Barack Obama. Barack Obama chose him to be his running mate, and so that gives him a seal of approval. And then the final thing is that he should get credit for a long, distinguished career in which he has been an outstanding public servant who really looked out for people at every level. And I know that there has kind of have two edges to that sword, and that long career means that he's got some controversial things too. But I think for the most part, that balances out in his favor. So I think he brings all those things to the table, which is more than just about anybody else. And so I think that explains where he why he is not just ahead, but ahead by a pretty good margin right now. I assume that that will narrow, but I think it's his to lose. He certainly could lose it, but I think it's his to lose at this point.
Well, will we find out tonight then? I mean, what happens if he sort of comes across as having lost his mojo?
I think that that would hurt him. I think that that if the sense is that he's kind of yesterday's news, that he really can't adjust to the current environment and really to what is a changing and transitioning electorate among Democrats, that I think he would suffer from that. But at the same time, though, just being Joe, being the guy that people like, being the guy that people trust, then I think that that will keep him where he's at. So I certainly think that he's got something to lose, but he got something to gain too. And to have something to gain, he doesn't have to present anything that anybody doesn't already see, know, and like.
But do you think, just like last night when there was some friction from people trying to get noticed who are back in the, you know, in the field, will that happen tonight? Will they pile on against Biden?
They might. You got to be very, very careful, though. I think that a week or so ago, when Cory Booker took a shot at Joe Biden, it may have slowed Biden just a little bit, but I think it hurt Cory Booker more. You got to be very, very careful. I don't think that there's tolerance among the Democratic electorate to really for Democrats really attacking each other. I think that even last night, the shot that Julian took against Beto was pretty tame in terms of political back and forth. And also, I think it's a little bit safer shot to go after Beto than it would be Joe Biden.
So given that the winner last night, and I know it's sort of facile to talk about winners at this early stage, and frankly, yesterday I had a professor emeritus of journalism from Northeastern who's written a book about 50 years of presidential debates. And I asked him, what's the best example? If there's too many people on the stage over two nights, then how would you do it? What example can you give me of a debate that really works? And he said the French do the best, where there's like one or two or maybe three candidates that just sit down. The moderators basically just stay out of it. They just introduce them, and then they stay out of it, and they all go at each other, and you get a real sense of who can handle the job. That makes sense, but you have to winnow the field to get to that point.
Yep.
So last night, everybody seems to see Elizabeth Warren as the winner. She certainly has the most to offer in terms of concrete proposals. How do you think, if she, and she seems to be going ahead in the polls at Bernie Sanders' expense, if she were to get up there with Biden territory, and if Biden sort of stumbles tonight, do you think some of the pundits are right, like Donnie Deutsch, who says that she'd just be the kiss of death, that Trump would have an easy time painting her as a socialist? How do you come down on that prognosis?
I'm worried about the same thing. Again, I like her, and I think that she's got a lot of appeal to her. And I think there's one very important and positive aspect to her rise, and that is that it's been at Bernie Sanders' expense. And I think the only major candidate that if they were nominated, I would feel like we wouldn't win is Bernie Sanders. I think he would be a sure loser. I think that, though, that Elizabeth Warren has a real challenge ahead of her. She's got to be able to have that populist appeal, and that populist appeal to a lot of activist Democrats, but at the same time, give the assurance to more mainstream people that she's not just going to come in with a wrecking ball and destroy institutions that people see as American institutions, not necessarily as Republican or right-wing institutions. But I think she has an opportunity to do that. But the concern is legitimate.
But how do you explain then, Matt Engel, that the oldest candidate in the field, Bernie Sanders, has the most support amongst the youngest Americans, the very people that I would assume that the Democratic Party need to activate?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think one is that they found out about him when it was versus Hillary Clinton, who was kind of the epitome of the institutional candidate and of the establishment candidate. And so I think Bernie, he represents that non-institutional or non-traditional candidate. The other thing is that they don't have the long history with Bernie Sanders. I mean, I've known Bernie and I've seen Bernie for 25 years, and he's not saying anything different now than he said 25 years ago, and it was just as non-productive at that time. And the other thing is that they don't appreciate or understand that Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. He still won't call himself a Democrat. He's never run as a Democrat. And so there is quite a bit of annoyance among longtime Democrats that somebody has come in and tried to hijack the Democratic Party, kind of in the way that Donald Trump succeeded in hijacking the Republican Party.
Yeah, but just to be hypothetical, and it may be useless exercise, but I think had Hillary Clinton chosen Bernie Sanders as her vice president instead of Senator Kaine, who didn't seem to do anything for her, and since she lost by such a narrow margin, wouldn't it be likely that she would be president today?
No, I think that they would have been able to attack Hillary as being this kind of longtime institutional person that people didn't really trust, and then attack Bernie as being ideological and being somebody who's a socialist who spent his honeymoon in Russia. That I think that Bernie Sanders is rife with trouble for Democrats if he's the nominee.
Right. Well, nowadays, of course, Republicans have a permanent honeymoon in Russia. So what a weird world.
That's exactly right. It's ironic, isn't it, that they would have attacked him as somebody who had Soviet ties, given what we know now.
Well, Matt Engel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with the lead negotiator of the JCPOA, the P5 plus one Iran nuclear deal, Ambassador Wendy Sherman. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ambassador Wendy Sherman, who's a professor of the practice of public leadership and director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School. In addition, she's a senior fellow at the school's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. And Ambassador Sherman is a senior counselor at Albright Stonebridge Group and a former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Wendy Sherman.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And as the lead negotiator on the U.S. participation in the P5+1, the JCPOA, as it's called, Iran deal, I mean, I don't know whether you're scratching your head or wondering what's going on here, because the pulling out of that deal at this point, you can see that since Trump canceled U.S. participation in that deal, things have unraveled with Iran. And what leverage the world had, after all, it wasn't just the United States. It was Russia, China, Germany, France, and the UK as well in the deal, that the initiative now is with the Iranians. They, in spite of all the bluster, at any moment, they're more or less, they sort of have a Samson strategy. You know, if you don't, won't let us sell our oil, we can be in a position that nobody sells their oil. So this is a very dangerous situation, surely, and it must be very upsetting for you.
Well, you know, I don't It's not a personal issue for me. It is an issue of the security of the United States of America. And certainly I feel for literally the hundreds of American diplomats, civil servants, citizens who supported and helped to construct the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, along with all of the experts from the P5+1, as you laid out, including the European Union and many other experts around the world who worked so hard to achieve this agreement to ensure that Iran would never obtain a nuclear weapon. So, yes, I feel for all of us who were involved in the deal, but I am more concerned and much sadder about what this means for the national security of the United States and the world. Your point, Ian, is very well taken, which is the agreement did not solve all of our problems with Iran. It was not constructed to do that. But it did ensure that Iran would not get a nuclear weapon. And that meant that we could turn our attention and all the tools at our disposal, including other sanctions, to push back on malign Iranian behavior in the region, their human rights abuses, their locking up of American citizens, their state sponsorship of terrorism, many things that we certainly would hope they would change.
But the nuclear issue is a second trigger looming in the background. There's enough triggers already with the IRGC in their little speedboats and all of that traffic in the narrow Strait of Hormuz. But when you say it's not personal for you, it does appear to be personal for Donald Trump. As far as I can tell, the only reason or the only rationale for breaking up the China, as he's done with the not just the JCPOA, but with the TPP and with the Paris Climate Accords, is that he just has some obsession, personal obsession about Obama and wants to destroy everything that Obama achieved. Is that, am I?
Well, it certainly does appear that way. I think the president also has a negotiating style that's really win-lose. He has started with fire and fury with North Korea. He's into fire and fury with Iran. He even did some fire and fury with Venezuela. None of those very, very tough problems have been solved by the president's approach. It seems he enjoys tactics but has no overall strategy. He doesn't see the entire landscape. All of the partners in the P5+1 that negotiated the deal, along with the European Union, have multiple agendas with the United States. And the president seems to only deal with one issue at a time in a bilateral, transactional way. And that doesn't see the entire landscape and understand that all of these issues and all of these relationships are multidimensional, and you have to figure out what your objectives are, what our interests are, what their interests are, and how we can get from here to there. And there doesn't seem to be any real strategy.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Wendy Sherman, who's a professor of the practice of public leadership and director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School. In addition, she's a senior fellow at the school's Belfast Center for Science and International Affairs. And Ambassador Sherman is a senior counselor at Albright Stonebridge Group and a former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. Well, there seems to, if there is a strategy, it's totally incoherent. And the president careens from offering Iranians peace and prosperity to threatening to obliterate them. So from their point of view, how do they see it? Because it's quite often, you know, if you look at history, we don't often put ourselves in the other player's shoes because we consider ourselves to be virtuous and the other side to be somewhat the opposite. And it may not be a useful analogy, but the pressure that was put on Japan prior to Pearl Harbor, where they only had a few months of oil supplies, and they had to decide whether to take the oil fields in Sumatra and Brunei. And from their point of view, economic warfare conducted by the United States put them at a breaking point. Are we under a similar situation? Now, I'm not making excuses for either the Iranians or the Japanese in an historical context, but nevertheless, if you're suffering from economic warfare and you're being strangled, don't you strike out?
Well, certainly you strike out, and what has happened is there's been an ascendancy of what I call the hardliners in Iran. That's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, and its special force, the Quds Force. They really want to own the Iranian economy. They want to own the black market during the sanctions. They never wanted the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. They are absolutely on the ascendancy. here in the United States, the National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary Mike Pompeo are on the ascendancy. They are, in my view, America's hardliners. They really want to push this to the brink, even if it means war. And so you get this escalatory ladder. And I was very glad that President Trump, 10 minutes to midnight, stepped away from a strike that was wildly out of proportion to taking down an unmanned drone. But the president, as you say, is sort of like a pinball machine. He keeps on ricocheting from one guardrail to the next, one hand saying, we're going to obliterate you, and the other hand saying, well, can we talk? He's going to have a hard time having a dialogue with North Korea as well, but with Iran, unless he puts something on the table that gives them an incentive to come to a dialogue or to a negotiating table. So, yes, we are in a very hard place. And although your analogy may not be exactly apt, a lot of people have also pointed to Barbara Tuchman's famous book, The Guns of August, and how through just a series of steps, many of which were inadvertent, misunderstood, miscommunications, we ended up in World War One.
But isn't there another element in this that I find quite frightening, and that is a symbiosis, not just between hawks on both sides, but a symbiosis between those who have religious and apocalyptic views? We know that the IRGC and certainly Ahmadinejad and others, and I assume the supreme leader, since he considers himself God's representative on earth, you know, Ahmadinejad was sending notes down to the well for the 12th Imam, their Messiah, to come out in an apocalyptic revelation. But we have in the Vice President and in the Secretary of State, both of those gentlemen believe in the rapture. So if you have the three horsemen of the apocalypse, Bolton, Pence, and Pompeo, and the fourth horseman, Trump, is at the moment is hobbled, that's not a very comforting thought.
Yes, I agree with you. There is a very profound sense of ideology that's at play here, both on the Iranian side and among the American hardliners. I'm perfectly respectful of people's religious views, but I don't believe that those religious views ought to dominate and direct American national security and foreign policy if it is decidedly not in the interest of our national security and foreign policy.
So the other person who had a role, as far as we can tell, in persuading Donald Trump from the beginning, apart from his obsession with Obama, to get out of the P5+1 was clearly Prime Minister Netanyahu, with whom Trump has close ties. There's a meeting going on, I think it was yesterday, maybe still today, between the National Security Advisors of Russia, Nikolai Patrushev, Israel, and John Bolton. And as far as I know, the deal on the table is that the Russians are going to help the Israelis ease the Iranians out of Syria, and in exchange, the U.S. recognizes Assad. I can't for the life of me see the Iranians giving up any ties to Hezbollah and in any way severing. And at this point, they may even have a land bridge, the so-called Shia Crescent.
Yes, well, in fact, Patrushev said as the meeting was concluding that Iran had a role and a place in Syria. So at least in public terms, there was absolutely no success in that three-way meeting. Whether things change on the ground, we will see. But clearly what John Bolton and Israel's national security advisor hope to achieve, at least in the public face, they did not.
So then what do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu has any buyer's remorse about this hardline drift into the Gulf? Obviously, he's also joined in beating the war drums with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince in Saudi Arabia. The former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, once said that the Saudis would like the Americans to fight to the Iranians to the last American. What's going on with Netanyahu? Is he happy with the situation? I mean, there again, there may be a symbiosis between him and the supreme leader. They can both demonize each other to keep their sort of base in line. And of course, there's an election going on in Israel as well.
Well, there's an election going on in Israel unless the prime minister can somehow hobble a coalition together and change the rules of the game, which seems to be something he is contemplating. But let's say there is an election coming this fall. I don't believe the prime minister is going to move away from his position, which is that we should not be in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. We should keep maximum pressure on. We should organize everyone to encourage that maximum pressure. No, I'm not sure that the prime minister thinks war is a good idea either. And I thought it was quite interesting that yesterday the United Arab Emirates said that although they believe that it was a state-sponsored attack on the tankers in the Gulf of Oman at the start of the Strait of Hormuz, they could not say which country was responsible. And I think that was the United Arab Emirates trying to de-escalate the situation and not encourage war. And I also think, though, that I want to be a little fair here, wherever I possibly can be. Although I think that the meeting that was just held in Bahrain for Jared Kushner to put the economic plan on that would bring condos to Gaza and save the world, which I don't think is an effective way to get peace in the Middle East. I think you have to do politics at the same time you're doing economics. But that said, there was a very remarkable interview between Barak Ravid, an Israeli journalist, and the foreign minister, Al-Khalifa, of Bahrain, who basically said that Israel is part of the neighborhood and has a place in the Middle East. And Israel has been working very hard at building its relationships with the Gulf states. And we know that Bahrain and Saudi Arabia are more than close. So it was a very interesting statement from the foreign minister, who's a very thoughtful person.
But at the heart of this struggle between, or this Cold War between the Sunni Gulf monarchs and the Iranians, and to some extent Qatar as well, and Egypt, of course, is on the side, along with, I guess, Israel, of the Gulf monarchs, isn't the subtext about political Islam, that the Saudis simply will not tolerate any form of political Islam? I mean, they're behind the generals in Sudan squelching democracy and murdering democratic activists. At least they're supporting.
Well, there's no doubt that a lot of this is a clash of the Sunni versus Shia Islam, and Saudi Arabia has been very adamant about their view on this, and you know, the Iranians are committed to Shia Islam, but have tried in the past to build a relationship with Saudi Arabia. And at one point, Saudi Arabia had a relationship with Iran. So it is not impossible, but certainly under the current circumstances, it appears to be.
But just in closing, I understood that one of the benefits of the JCPOA, the P5+1, was that it did force some moderation on the part of the Iranians, at least in terms of this theocratic kleptocracy, were forced to reveal the books. And people got really alarmed and furious when they found out how much money the mullahs were creaming off the state budgets and how much money was going to Hezbollah and Hamas, etc. So does that indicate at the end of the day that what we should be focusing on is the people inside Iran that want freedom and democracy and want to join the West? And as far as I know, if you threaten the country, they rally around the flags, and this unpopular
Absolutely.
Government is you are emboldening and helping this unpopular government rather than forming a cleavage between them and the people you want to liberate.
Yes, there's no doubt that if the president takes us to war with Iran, which would be catastrophic, the people of Iran will rally around their government, whether they like their government or not. And that indeed the intense maximum pressure campaign after so many years, when in fact Iranian people saw perhaps some light with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has only intensified many citizens' belief that not only is there no trust between the United States and Iran, which I think continues to this day, there is no respect either. And that does not help the Iranian people in the long run.
Well, Ambassador Wendy Sherman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too. And I've been speaking with Ambassador Wendy Sherman, who's a professor of the practice of public leadership and director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School. In addition, she's a senior fellow at the school's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. And Ambassador Sherman is a senior counselor at Albright Stonebridge Group and a former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loves.